Official session moderator, Jeffrey Norcross. But before I do that, let's just take a real quick look at those poll responses. So if you haven't cast your vote in the middle bottom of your screen on your affiliation, quickly do so. It does look like just over a third of the audience is coming from EPA. Almost two-thirds of the audience are state regulators, and then about 2% or so are tribal representatives. So we have a nice distribution of attendees today. So thanks very much for participating. There will be more of those later on. And Jeff, feel free to begin.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. My name is Jeff Norcross, and I'm a member of EPA Region 1's RCRA Lead Region team. Thank you for participating in today's Expert Brown Bag webinar on long-term stewardship at corrective action sites. During this webinar, your hosts will discuss why long-term stewardship is needed at corrective action sites to ensure that long-term treatment or controls remain in place and are operational and protective. Your hosts will also highlight work that EPA has been doing in this area and share thoughts on long-term stewardship moving forward. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's presenters, who are Tammy Moore from EPA Region 5, Lisa Messenger from EPA Region 7, and Dan Weinberg from EPA Region 1. Tammy Moore is a manager in the Remediation and Reuse Branch in EPA Region 5's Land and Chemicals Division. As a manager, Tammy's responsibilities include management of the RCRA Corrective Action and TSCA PCB remediation programs. Tammy has worked at EPA for 17 years in a variety of positions and has extensive experience as a public health practitioner and environmental scientist. Lisa Messenger has worked in EPA Region 7 as a geologist and project manager in the RCRA Corrective Action Unit since 2014. Prior to that, she worked for several years in the private sector, and before that at the Kansas Department of Health and Environment. Lisa is the project lead for Region 7's RCRA Long-Term Stewardship Database Development Project. And finally, Dan Weinberg is the section chief for EPA Region 1's Corrective Action and PCB Cleanup Programs. Dan, along with his staff, has been working to develop a long-term stewardship program in Region 1 and looks forward to working in this area more with other regions and states around the country. Prior to his current role, Dan worked as an on-scene coordinator for 11 years in Region 1's removal program. He's been working at EPA since 2002. So again, thank you, Tammy, Lisa, and Dan, for hosting today's webinar. It's a lot of work to do this. I appreciate it. And at this time, I would like to hand things over to Tammy Moore.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Tammy Moore. As Dan has already introduced me, I'm here in the EPA Region 5. And so I'll just go ahead and get started with the presentation. So the question we have right now is, why do we need long-term stewardship? So we're at the stage in the RCRA Corrective Action Program where the majority of our 2020 baseline cleanup sites have reached final remedy construction, actually over 67% have, and most of those sites have contamination that remains above unrestricted use and required controls. We are at the stage that the program needs to ensure that the sites are maintained in perpetuity in an effective and consistent way. So we have had a lot of situations that have arisen that has really made us realize the importance of long-term stewardship. So some of those situations that we've experienced is that we've had facilities have a change in owner and operator after the remedy has been constructed. We've had property and maintenance cease after a facility has gone into bankruptcy. We have had an unanticipated changes in land use, and sometimes actually from industrial to residential land use. We've had components of the remedy that have not been maintained, such as monitoring wells and caps. We have had unreported releases at facilities where the remedy has already been constructed. We have had issues with enforceability of old institutional controls. And we also need an opportunity to reevaluate the effectiveness of remedies and potential to accelerate remedial goals when we can. We also need to ensure public and worker safety, and we need to make sure that we are protecting groundwater and drinking water sources. We also need to make sure that there is oversight of engineering and institutional controls at all levels of government. So what should EPA and the states be doing under RCRA for long-term stewardship? we should be developing and implementing an effective site and monitoring process. We also need to make sure that ICs and ECs are available to the public, and also make sure that the public knows that the facilities are making progress to maintaining or meeting performance standards. We also need to work with site owners to track and prevent and address the failures of remedy components, and to either work collaboratively with the site owners or utilize enforcement tools. So this page, or this part of the presentation, has a schematic on the long-term stewardship process considerations that we're looking at here at the different regions. So we're looking at long-term stewardship controls during the remedy process, or when we should look at implementing long-term stewardship. We're looking at how to implement, monitor, and how to actually end long-term stewardship. And we're also looking at when to make adjustments actually during the monitoring process, in or if we need to implement enforcement. So what is our current focus? So right now we're looking at how to design an effective long-term stewardship approach. We're looking at, should we be implementing ICs or ECs during or after the remedy decision, during corrective measures? We're also looking at different types of enforcement tools as well. We're also looking at more effective ways to monitor the protectiveness of institutional and engineering controls over time. So that may include more inspections, looking at different types of oversight tools, which includes mapping, and also looking at ways to maybe incorporate annual certification. We're also looking at different ways to manage and to measure and track the way that we do the long-term stewardship, whether it's tracking and monitoring the engineering and institutional controls themselves, or the actual inspections that we may do as a part of the measuring, as a part of the long-term stewardship process. So what are the actual components of a long-term stewardship program? So right now we're looking at, is there a possibility to build in language into the remedy selection process? We're looking at implementation of the long-term stewardship components, such as financial insurance. Maybe we should do more engagement at the local level, or actually make sure that we provide GIS locations and boundary information about controls and use restrictions. We're also looking at different ways to monitor and looking at different ways of maintenance of long-term stewardship components. So that may include annual certification to make sure that the controls remain in place and are effective. We're also looking at different types of agency review and oversight, whether it's through inspections or five-year reviews. We're looking at different ways to track engineering and IC components, and also maybe thinking about ways to prioritize the sites that may have groundwater plumes or vapor intrusion issues so that we make sure that they remain under control. We're also looking at different ways to implement enforcement for long-term stewardship, and also the public notification component, whether it's making sure that we have information available, such as mapping or the remedies themselves. So I'll turn it over to Lisa for her part of her case study from Region 7.
Okay. And just before, Lisa, if you don't mind, before you jump on in there, I want to draw the audience's attention to some polls that we've popped up on the bottom portion of your screen. So if you all look in the lower left portion of your screen, our presenters were looking for a little more background about the audience, and so we've asked you two questions. The first question in the bottom left, do you have a long-term stewardship program or LTS components in your cleanup programs? And you can simply click yes, no, or don't know, and that'll help us get a sense again of where you're coming from, respectively, in the audience. And then if you happen to have one of these programs, the next question on the middle bottom portion of your screen simply says, what state, tribe, or agency are you from? And it looks like we're getting a number of answers being typed in there. So I'm going to leave those up on the screen here for just a few more seconds to get some additional input. But it does look like just over half the audience, so about 56% of them, do have one of these programs or components where they're working. About 15% don't, and then about a third of them are not sure. And the ranges from California to Hawaii, Indiana, EPA offices, a number of states, Arizona, Georgia, Iowa, North Carolina, Arizona, Montana, Missouri. So a lot of really great specific information is coming in, and it does look like many of you do have one of these programs where you're currently working. So thanks for sharing that. And I'll kind of leave that again up on the screen here for a minute. And Lisa, whenever you're ready to get started, go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Jean. Today I will be presenting on EPA Region 7's tools for managing our RCRA LTS program and workload. But first, I would like to give you a quick background of Region 7's Worker Corrective Action universe. We currently have approximately 400 facilities subject to corrective action over a four-state region that includes Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, and Nebraska. Region 7 is the lead agency for all corrective action work in Iowa, and a small subset of work in the other states, including TSCA PCB remediations, some post-closure and permitting facilities, and former Minuteman II ICBM facilities in Missouri. Those are the little red dots in Missouri. EPA's national database, RCRA Info, provides the ability to track when controls are placed on a facility through the use of corrective action event codes, such as CA-770s for engineering controls and CA-772s for institutional controls. However, this is pretty much where tracking and management of controls at the national level ends. As our EPA lead facilities reach remedy construction, the facilities in green on the map, as you can see, and a growing number of final remedies include either institutional or engineering controls, it became apparent that a more robust tool for us was necessary to better track, manage, and assess these controls to ensure that they remain effective. Gene, I'm not able to click through. There we go. So what do I mean by ensuring that the controls remain effective? Well, as Tammy spoke earlier, unanticipated changes to land use is a real possibility. Take, for instance, this real-world example of a facility where controls are placed through the use of a restrictive covenant and engineered caps to mitigate exposure to residual metals contamination in soil. Well, back in 2011, remedy was constructed and a covenant was placed on the entirety of the property restricting land use to non-residential. The final covenant was placed, the final remedy decision and covenant placed in 2011 required that the gravel caps were to be maintained and remain effective, and every 5 years, the property owner was to report on compliance with the covenant. Since 2011, property ownership had changed after the original facility owner defaulted on their property tax, and the facility was subdivided into multiple property owners through a tax lien foreclosure process. The EPA was not notified during this process. Now there are six different property owners, one of which eventually contacted us late in 2014 to let us know that they had acquired the property and needed to do some cleanup of rubble piles and that were left in place after the on-site buildings were demoed by the previous owner and wanted to make sure that they were complying with the restrictions. However, they were unsure of where the caps were supposed to be, and if you look on the picture on the left, you can see why. They had no documentation other than the covenant, which was limited in describing the location of the caps without an on-the-land survey. So we conducted a site visit with the property owner to assess conditions and found, less than 5 years later, that the gravel caps were not maintained, and subsidence and ponding was actually occurring. Additionally, monitoring wells installed during the investigation were discovered to not have been plugged and abandoned, and in fact, they were damaged. We also found that during the tax lien foreclosure, a small parcel was actually zoned residential for residential use, directly violating the covenant. And to make matters worse, the new owner of this small parcel claimed she was unaware of the covenant and five-year reporting requirement. This case study highlights the fact that long-term stewardship of controls in place, including on-the-ground assessments and ongoing communication with the landowners, is necessary. So how are we handling this type of workload within Region 7 EPA, and what are our priorities for EPA lead facilities? We have created an internal database that will not only provide transparency to the public regarding what controls have been implemented and where, but leverages those MAPS controls to help the program ensure that they remain effective and protective in the long term through a more streamlined management approach. This one-stop electronic center in the form of our LTS database greatly improves both efficiency and quality in tracking and managing LTS efforts summarized on this slide. This database is currently only internal to the EPA, however, several of our states have already developed their own controls database, including Missouri's LTS tool. So now, I would like to go ahead and give you a brief demo of Region 7's LTS database and tracking tool.
Okay, and so while Lisa pulls up her screen, just a quick reminder, if you'd like to make her screen larger so it's easier to follow along with her live demonstration, I'll remind everybody that there should be a button in the upper right corner of her window where she's showing stuff. It looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. You all can click that four arrow button at any time to make her screen bigger. All right, Lisa, go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. So this is our database, and we securely sign in every time we get in here. So that makes it, it gives us the ability to access this on a mobile device on the field. So when we go out and do the field assessments, everything you see here is readily accessible in the field. So I'm just going to take you straight to that case study I was talking about. Click on the entry. And so the first thing that pops up is the facility homepage, where we have a lot of internal information, such as who's the project manager, who's the lead agency, facility status. This actually directly connects to our worker info database, so everything in gray is directly pulled in, so there's no duplicity. We are able to go in, and so our project managers actually have editable rights and can access this themselves. And they go in and describe the facility, describe the contamination that's residual, any facility controls, what the land use looks like now, as well as any facility responsibility. And for Blackhawk, they are, like I mentioned, required to report every 5 years on their compliance with the CAP and the institutional control. As we're going down the left side of the web page here, we have what are called pages or modules. And the next one is our interactive map, which is the more exciting piece. And so all of our engineering and institutional controls that we have here in Region 7, and we actually have maps including state lead facilities as well, they're all in here. And we've mapped all the controls based on the legal descriptions as well as the survey information. So this is the best data that we can get. We can underlay either a street map or an aerial photo, and this actually uses Bing aerial photo maps. So unfortunately, this is not the most updated one. These buildings have all been demoed, as I previously discussed, and the new owner, loosely follows these parcels that are bounded in yellow. On the right, you see a legend. The red square is our facilities that have not achieved remedy construction or a 550. The red circles are our facilities that have achieved the remedy constructed. And if you scroll even further down, you have a legend for your engineering controls as well as your institutional controls. So out here, we have both a 772 PR, that's a restrictive covenant, and our 770 NZ, that's our small cap areas. We have one there, and we have one on the eastern portion. In here, we can also turn off controls as we'd like to see them separately. And at the bottom are all the controls listed out by parcel. When you click on the map, it brings up a dialogue box for each control. So the CA-772 has the covenant actually linked to it. So we can click on that and bring up the PDF documents anytime, including in the field. So here's the covenant that's linked to the map. And what I want to draw your attention to here are two pieces of the covenant that's very important for this database. One is the AULs, or the activity and use limitations and terms. And if you can see here in section F, there's the 5-year reporting requirement by the property owners. This covenant also ensures that the cap is going to be maintained, as well as the property use is restricted to non-residential and no installation of water supply wells. The other thing I wanted to draw your attention to is the legal description itself. Let's get there. I think it's at the very back of this one. It's a very long legal description for this facility because it's divided up into several parcels. And the thing with legal descriptions is they look like a foreign language. It's almost impossible to read. But what we're able to do in GIS is to convert this legal description or COGO them into the real-world boundaries that you see on the map. And so we've tried to do that for every one that we have. And you can see this is down to the hundredth of a foot. So it's as accurate as we can with GIS. So moving on, you can get to the list of documents, and the PMs can upload their documents directly. We also have a list of events, and these are all the controls, including the engineering controls, institutional controls, and we can also go ahead and add, and what we are adding in here are orders, permits, voluntary mechanisms, and any authority mechanisms that we have. We can set them as active, we can query them by type, and we can put their origin date. And where that origin date comes in handy is in the next page, which is our reporting page. And this is really the need of our LTF database. This is really the request by management of getting this database up and running. So here we have all of our reporting requirements, including that five-year facility compliance report. Based on the origin of the control itself, we can go in, each PM can go in and directly edit the frequency of reporting based on that original date. And what that does is the system automatically calculates a next report date. And what that says is 30 days before a report is due, it sends out the system automatically sends out a tickler notification by email to the project manager and management to let them know that a reporting is due. In EPA Region 7, we've adopted an assessment program where we do desktop assessments annually and an on-site assessment every few years, typically 3 years, but it's depending on the site-specific conditions. A few other pieces of this database is the dashboard customizable reports, and these were developed to help management balance the workload for these assessments. So what PMs have how many controls that they're assessing, what controls are coming up within the next 30 days, what controls are overdue that we either haven't received or haven't signed off on. And everything here is, of course, linkable back to the facility itself. And some other tools at the top include our checklists. And so we have ready access to our checklists, our assessment checklist, or the forms. These are also readily available in the field. There we go. We also have a direct link to RCRA info. And one last thing for this demo, EPA is embracing lean process excellence events. And so we've embraced Region 1 permit application process excellence. And so to evaluate and check the metrics of a permit application, we've actually included that in the database because why not? This sends out those notifications when certain pieces of the application are due, and it is we're also able to determine what's overdue, what's within time, and how long are we able to get these applications through. And I think that's it for my demo. I will now go ahead and give it back to Jean if she has a polling question before it goes to Dan Weinberg.
Okay, so I think we're going to call a few things up here on the screen, and again, just reminding everybody here where we were at those polling questions about those long-term stewardship programs. It was still about half of the audience who looked like they had them, and then many, many states have listed theirs as well as a number of EPA offices. So I think at this point we're going to go head on over to Daniel to get to carry on with the talk.
Okay, thank you, Jean. And Lisa, this is Dan Weinberg, and I'm from Region 1, the New England states. Our corrective action program includes all of our states being authorized, and there's about 300 corrective action sites on the 2020 priority list, just for a little background about our region. Here in the region, we've been working on how to develop a long-term stewardship program and primarily been focused on how we would conduct assessments in the field. I do want to stress that we feel like we're at the very beginning stages of this, and I think I could say that for the EPA overall, that while we have some regions that have been developing various aspects of this program and how to get out and check on sites, we're at a stage now where we're wanting to develop a program at the national level and looking forward to working with all the regions and also states and tribes that may have experiences doing this type of work already and ideas for how to move this forward and take care of these sites into the future. So for my part here today, I wanted to go over a couple case studies from LTS assessments we've done, and then spend a little bit of time providing some detail on the tools we're using to conduct these field assessments. I think that there's probably a lot of practitioners on the webinar here today, and for us, this has been a key part of how we organize and develop a more holistic program around these on-the-ground field visits. I have a few folks in my group that have really been doing all the work to develop these tools and get out there and check on sites, and I'm really just speaking for them today, so I appreciate all the work that they've done. So this first case study is an example of a site that we went through this process on, and it turned out that there weren't any problems, which isn't a bad thing. Hopefully, as long-term stewardship assessments occur at more and more corrective action sites, there will be many where this is the case. But this was a site where we, doing this long-term stewardship assessment, gave us the opportunity to revisit the site conceptual model, assess the containment system that was part of the remedy, and evaluate the VI concerns that were that had been there all along for the site, and discuss all of those with the state agency who is the lead for the site. The outcome of that was that we determined collectively with our state partners that the remedy was still protective, and I think everyone involved felt like it was a productive conversation and review of the site conditions. At the second facility, a little bit different situation, where this site that was had much work done on it, with activity use restrictions in place. Those activity use restrictions had changed over time, and as the EPA revisited and took a look at this site, we understood that some of the uses had changed. There had been daycares that had become tenants in these buildings. There was residential development occurring, and there was potential for VI concerns there. As a result of revisiting this site, in this case, EPA is working with the facility to reassess the indoor air and working with them under a consent order. So now I want to talk about some of the electronic tools that we're using to make these assessments happen. And here in the region, we're striving for an all-electronic workflow, and we feel like that's key to developing a field program that is sustainable and achievable with our resource constraints. So you can see in terms of the tools, we're using a couple ESRI tools, Survey123 and Art Collector. We're mapping what we're doing on EPA's geo platform, and we use an access database both for our long-term stewardship work as well as tracking a lot of information overall about our corrective action sites. And we've stuck with using access primarily, while even though it has its limitations, we've stuck with it because it allows us to maintain and update and change the database in our program as opposed to needing higher level IT support, and that's been really important to us. Again, considering resource constraints. And also I'll mention that we're using a tablet out in the field. And I mentioned the always keeping an eye to the level of effort. Our goal as we develop this further is to really develop a program where we have a routine file review, we get out to the sites, and then we're finalizing this checklist or report very quickly afterward. And that report is as streamlined as possible, so there's as little time spent on finalizing it after the field effort. We're also trying to include, and this is an area where we have a lot more thinking to do, but gathering information about renewable energy potential at these sites and sharing it with the property owners if they seem interested, and also trying to do, at least for the time being, some level of assessment about climate resiliency and concerns at those sites. You can see in the image here on the right, that's the Survey 123 checklist, and I just wanted people to get a sense of what it looks like. And this is being filled out both in the office ahead of time for the pre-visit check, and then out in the field, both with pick list type of entries and also handwriting is possible with an electronic pen that then converts that handwritten into typed text, which is very key for data quality and also getting the information into the database. I'm not going to go through this workflow in detail, but I just wanted to flash it up here so people can get a sense of the different parts that bring this all together, and also if there's a greater level of interest in what we're doing, this will be in the materials that you can access after the webinar, and you can take a closer look and feel free to contact me if you have any further questions. But this basically shows the flow of how we're preparing for an assessment, getting out there, and then processing the written information, the photos that go along with features at the site, and getting it all into our Access database, which really functions as the hub for all this, and then outputting a report that we share with the facility and then goes into our document record keeping system. And some of these outputs end up on the map as well. Here I'm showing an image again of the form that gets filled out on the tablet in the field. And on the right, you can see how Art Collector can be used to, in the field, draw a feature that maybe we weren't able to establish in the office or wasn't part of the record ahead of time. Perhaps it's a capped area, or it might be a point that we're grabbing that represents a monitoring well that we weren't aware of, or things like that. And then those features can be incorporated into our Region 1 Corrective Action Map, which has long-term stewardship information on it. This is a view of our Region 1 Corrective Action Map that's housed in GeoPlatform, and I just wanted to, again, give people an idea of what we're doing. You can see we're putting in all the site boundaries. We're currently working on getting all the activity use restriction boundaries mapped and any other institutional controls, eventually all the engineering controls as well. And I just have a pop-up there to show that we're working towards having this be a one-stop shop where people can access the site profile page for that corrective action site, where there'll be more information and also ready access to publicly available documents. I should note that currently this map is not available to the public, but that is our goal, to make all this information available to the public in the future. Part of developing all these tools, including the map and our record management system, is that we're using this long-term stewardship effort to drive making more of our corrective action information readily available to the public, which is important for the public to have access to that, and also we hope that it'll reduce our levels of effort to provide information to the public when there's inquiries about sites. This is another image in the map, and I just wanted to point out that you can see here, this is the institutional control, the land use restriction, and there's a hyperlink to see the document itself, the state record for the land use restriction, which we now have housed in our document management system. And quickly, just this shows how we're capturing the monitoring well points and just giving the sense that a user can go here and interact with the site and check out the different features on the site and see what the latest long-term stewardship report shows. And you can see here on the next slide the latest picture of the engineering control or the institutional control or monitoring well or capped area. In this case, there's a picture showing a monitoring well. And then finally, a quick image of the report, which we are, this is what our final report looks like. As I mentioned earlier, the Access database is the hub of all of this. A report is generated out of Access in PDF format. We share the draft report as it stands right now with the facility to make sure there's agreement that we captured everything correctly, and then we finalize it. And that's a part in this process that we're always looking to reduce the amount of time and level of effort to get to that end final report. So with that, I'll just mention again that this is a program that here in the region we're focused on the field component and developing those tools because we think that it's important to just get out to the sites and see what's going on at these sites. We also feel like doing that work will help inform how we develop this process. It's also an additional opportunity for us to collaborate with our states in New England about the sites and about this program, but that we're hoping to develop a more comprehensive long-term stewardship program and bring the different things that have been going on in the other regions and other states together for a more comprehensive program. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Tammy to talk about a case study in Region 5.
All right, so this is Tammy Moore, Region 5. I'm just going to quickly go over a case study that we had here for an actual EPA lead corrective action site. So here in our region, we share a hefty workload with our Region 5 states, and so we have a lot of project managers that does direct implementation of corrective action. So we had a project manager that had went to a site visit for her site called National Coppers in Michigan. And the situation here was that the new site owners had leased the building out to different occupants, and a couple of the occupants included a dance studio for small children and also a martial arts studio for small children. So there was concern about the potential receptors and also the fact that, you know, because these are small kids, there also may have been pregnant women that were coming to these actual dance studios to bring their children, and that there were actually vapor intrusion issues at this site. So even though there were institutional controls in place, they were not being followed. So the EPA project manager was able to see that, and this basically resulted in us doing increased outreach to the owners and occupants of the build, actually the tenants of the building and the occupants, so that they knew about the TCE levels and about the indoor air conditions, and that resulted in the leases not being released, not being renewed to the sensitive receptors, and more indoor air monitoring. So this was a really good example of how long-term stewardship is important in the sense of we need to make sure that we are staying on top of the ownership changes and making sure that they are aware of the situations that are going on at these sites that they purchase, and making sure that the use restrictions remain in place, and also that, you know, there's a component of, you know, people who permit these sites or allow, you know, the renting or new tenants to come into these new sites, and local government being aware of issues that may be going on at our corrective action sites. We also had a pilot study here where we had our RCRA inspectors do inspections for us, and that actually also resulted in us finding out that a lot of our sites were not maintaining their engineering controls. We saw that they had kind of let monitoring wells languish or actually be destroyed, and so we've made it one of our goals for FY18 is to develop a long-term stewardship checklist so that our actual project managers, in addition to, you know, utilizing our inspectors when we can to do actual inspections, we can have our project managers do long-term stewardship inspections as well. So we're developing a checklist that they can use, and we've been piloting it at a couple of sites. We're going to have a couple more project managers utilize this checklist to see if there's tweaks that we need to be that need to be made, how the flow of information that we're able to collect at the sites, and it would also depend on the size and scope of the sites on how we do these inspections and how useful the information we have on our checklist will be. So we're working on that internally, and we're also working on our, we're at the beginning stages of looking at more electronic databases and utilizing GIS data as well. Because here in our region, we have a large workload, and we're responsible for these remedies that we have selected at our site, so we want to make sure that we're staying on top of that work as well. And that's basically all I have. So I'll turn it back over to Jean.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and get ready for our Q&A portion of the session. So I'll just remind the live audience, if you haven't sent in your questions or comments, that Q&A window should appear in the lower right corner of your screen. You can click on the empty box at the very bottom of the Q&A window where you can put your mouse cursor and start typing in your questions and comments. I think we'll go ahead and let Jeff Norcross start reading through some of those questions and comments, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have left. Jeff?
Yeah, thanks. So Tammy, during early in the program, during your talk, there was a question, is an environmental covenant program included in long-term stewardship?
Yes, that should be one of the components of long-term stewardship. We have different ways of implementing environmental covenants, whether it's through a universal environmental covenant or as a part of our remedy. So that's definitely one of the components of long-term stewardship. And also making sure that hopefully we, you know, here because we do a lot of work at the federal level, we try to make sure that our states sign off on our environmental covenants so that they're enforceable as well and that they can stay on top of them, and just making sure that we maintain those and they remain enforceable. So that's an important component of that.
Thank you. Lisa, a couple of questions that came in during your talk. One is a compliment from one of the other regions about your database, and a question, can other EPA regions copy, share this database for their regional universe? How would a non-IT savvy person learn how to do this?
Well, thank you for the kudos. I appreciate it. It was a lot of hard work. Yes, I think we could collaborate, maybe. I can give you my contact information, or Jean could, and maybe get a hold of me, and we can work on that. So as far as our database goes, we did all the work in-house within the region. The bulk of the work was the GIS work, so converting those legal descriptions and survey boundaries into the geographic areas. And you would need at least a beginning to intermediate level GIS technician or group of technicians, which is what we used. Actually, we used in summer interns, so we did the bulk of our work over 2 summers. We used the Oracle database. We needed some additional functionality that maybe other regions don't necessarily need. We don't have a separate electronic document system, and we were interested in more of the automated tickler notifications and workarounds like that. So we did need to have a database manager, which we have internally, as well as a user interface developer, I guess you could call him. So if you're interested, maybe we could collaborate more offline with sharing the database structure.
Great, thanks. And a couple other questions for you, Lisa. One, do the state PMs input facility information and IC documents?
So we did all the work in putting all the control documents in there. For Region 7, we wanted to focus on getting our EPA lead facility, Corrective LTS Universe, under control first. Now that we've done that, we've started reaching out to others, to our regional states. But when there was information that we needed, we were able to reach out to the states. And like I said, Missouri already had an LTS tool up and running, and they had a lot of the GIS information ready to go. So it was somewhat collaborative with them. But right now, only EPA is entering those IC, EC information. We pretty much have it all done. Right now, we're just in maintenance mode. So when a new covenant or a new engineering control is placed, we're just inputting it. We have enough resources to be able to do that.
Okay, thank you. This may be more generally addressed to all the presenters, but it came in when you were speaking, Lisa. It says, if we put a site under an institutional control, then after a couple of years, we find that a contamination plume in groundwater is no longer stable or constrained, what do you suggest we do? Would you recommend to bring the site back to active remediation? If so, what will be the land use status?
I'll take a shot at that, but I think it comes down to a very site-specific situation. I don't think we could answer that in generally, but I would encourage you to work with your region. I'm not sure what region you're in, if you're not already doing so on this site, and determine what's needed to modify the remedy to make sure that it's effective. It sounds like this is a situation where something stopped working or didn't work as planned, and there needs to be some adjustment. In terms of the land use status, I'm not sure that I understand that question, but if there's an activity use restriction on the site, I think that if it doesn't encompass the conditions of the plume or changing conditions, you'd want that to be modified as well.
Does anyone else want to address that, Tammy or Lisa? Okay. I'm just reading a question here. A question is, the presentations mentioned several instances of routine agency inspection. What is your opinion of using annual reporting by property owners of property conditions in lieu of regulatory inspections? Anyone want to take that one on?
This is Tammy Moore from Region 5. I think that's fine. I think one of our states, Michigan, actually has an annual certification process where they have the facilities kind of send in information to ensure that they are maintaining their environmental covenants, their engineering controls, and their institutional controls. So that's something that we're looking to explore as well. And I think that that's totally acceptable as part of long-term stewardship, as long as they're getting it certified by, you know, a geologist or something like that, if there's engineering controls in place, but or their contractor. But, yeah, that's totally acceptable.
This is a question for Dan. Who is doing site assessments in Region 1? EPA folks, state folks? Are the staff doing the assessments from the enforcement program or the RCRA corrective action program?
Okay, thanks for that question. Right now I have three RCRA facility managers, project managers for corrective action, developing these tools and doing the long-term stewardship assessments, which is different than the other part of the RCRA house, which does both EPA lead and state, they do active facility operating inspection. So this is much different. This is going to look at the corrective action cleanup components at a site. So I have those project managers doing it. We're discussing these ideas with our states in New England and asking them for assistance and input as we, I would say, develop this first stage of the program. We hope that in the future we'll have more of a formal program set up where we're collaborating with our state specifically on how we prioritize sites to go to, who might be doing the in-field assessments, and trying to come up with a plan that where we're complementing each other's resources. You know, or for instance, a state may say, you know, we haven't had a chance to get out to this site in a long time. It'd be great to get some eyes on the ground. We know that we're getting an annual self-certification, but it's been a long time. That might be a place where we'd complement their program that's already in place.
Okay. A general question for Tammy, Lisa, or Dan. Any plans for a national long-term stewardship program checklist tool for use by the states? Has there been talk of that at EPA?
I think there's, in general, talk about working on the idea of a long-term stewardship program that would have some varying degree of national consistency. And part of that discussion is where do we have standardized tools and where do we allow for variation that accommodates the different situations in the states and the regions. One of the goals is certainly not to be having redundant efforts, but also at the same time to allow for those differences in the types of universes and types of facilities and types of state programs across the country. We are looking to work more closely with the states, either through ATSWAMO and also one-on-one conversations with the regions and their states. So I think we're hopefully entering into a phase where there's more conversation about what things are going to look like, including the tools. As far as tools that Region 1 have, and Lisa said the same thing about the database, for what we have so far, we're happy to share anything we've been working on so far if people are interested. I don't know if Lisa or Tammy want to add anything to that.
Yeah, just in the future, we hope to work closely with the states to develop tools, and hopefully it's something that everybody can use depending on how your program works.
Okay. This is a question for Lisa. One of the examples you showed says, I can see the gravel cap blocks access to contaminated soil in this example. Were there any concerns about rain, water permeation into the soil or contaminants as well?
Sure. So when the gravel cap was placed in 2011, they had already conducted the RCRA facility investigation where by using those groundwater wells that I showed in the slide that there was no leaching of metals, so this was metals contamination only that was constrained to the upper couple feet of soil. And so it was demonstrated during the investigation by looking at the groundwater that it was not leaching, so there was no concern.
Thank you. This is a question for Tammy. In the last case study with the tenant, what was the underlying enforcement mechanism? Was the owner obligated to comply, but not any of the lessees? We've struggled with the role of lessees in these types of situations.
The onus is totally on the operator, the owner, rather than the lessees. The owner needs to be responsible for who they lease this property out to, especially if they know that they have institutional controls in place that's restricting certain uses. So if this person is struggling with who is responsible, it's the responsibility is on the owner of the property always. And this is a site that I'm sure we have under an order, an administrative order.
Okay. Another question. Has Region 1, 5, or 7 used long-term stewardship for PCB cleanup sites? If so, do you have example covenants that capture the spirit of LTS?
For Region 1, we haven't engaged a PCB cleanup site using the process and the tools I went over. But in our PCB program, when there's sites that require long-term maintenance plans, deed restrictions, and things like that, that is occurring at those sites. I could definitely see how what's being developed under the context of corrective action could apply to PCB cleanup sites as well in the future.
All right. Well, there are a few more questions, but in the interest of keeping on schedule, I think we should wrap it up. So thank you very much. Jean, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay. Well, I appreciate everybody hanging in here for just another moment while we walk through a few final reminders, and then we'll go ahead and close things out for today. We did have just over 270 individuals join us for today's live broadcast, so I want to thank all of you who were able to sign in today. We hope that you will save the date for our next session, our next RCRA Experts Brown Bag webinar on tools for quicker cleanups and PCB and RCRA corrective action sites is going to take place on June 6th, 2018 from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern, where we will be joined by speakers from EPA Region 5 and EPA Region 9. So there will be additional information coming out about that seminar soon, so please stay tuned and hopefully you can save that time slot on your calendar to join us. If you're interested in replaying the previously recorded RCRA Expert webinars, those are actually already available on the seminar homepage, so the same page that you came to check in and join us for today's live broadcast. There already is a box or header on there that says RCRA Expert Brown Bag Series Archive. If you click on that, a whole list will pop out, and you'll be able to replay previously recorded webinars in this series. We do have copies of the presentation material available on the resources or links page. That is already hyperlinked on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. I also included it in the Q&A window for all of you. You'll also find contact information for our presenters and organizers. So I think at a few points people had offered to reach out and contact some of these speakers with some of your questions, so you can find their information there. And then if you could take just a brief moment and fill out our short online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content and the method that we used to deliver it. That will greatly help us continue to offer these free online training sessions. That feedback form is also the way you can earn a participation certificate. When you fill the form out, there's a box at the very bottom to check that says that you certified you were here for the entire session. When you check that box and send in your feedback, you should immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can either save or print out for your own records. If you don't check the box, you won't get one of those. So you may need to repeat the feedback process if you forget to do it the first time. If you participated in a large group, each person can fill out their own feedback form and then get their own certificate. So again, under one registration, you can send that feedback form link out to those who joined you in the room, and each person can get their own. While we do not issue CEUs or PDHs for these seminars, many people are able to get these certificates, save their registration emails, or download the slides, and that's enough documentation to verify they attended and earn credit with their accrediting institution. So again, I want to thank those over 280 people who joined us for today's live broadcast and hope that you'll join us on the next session on June 6th when we carry on with the RCRA Expert Brown Bag Series. Thank you to those presenters and organizers who took time out of their busy days to join us. And I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's